What is our opportunity to have a session of questions and answers discussion? Tomorrow it will be more a matter of sharing together what we've experienced with this. But also cutting it short by 15 minutes. So I'd just ask if you could try to keep your questions as brief as possible, not too elaborate. And we'll do our best on our side to make our answers short and pithy and to the point. May not always be possible, but we'll give it a go. I do have a couple of notes here. This is a sort of, is there room for some nonsense in this serious world, profound world of Buddhism? I hope so.
Oh, that one. What is Buddhism today? Do Buddhists follow the word of the Buddha? Do they worship him? If he was to rise up and see the Buddhists and the Buddha station, what would he think? I do not know. Yesterday
we were left with hanging on this point with about 3 words. It does. And I think that there's something about the practice of meditation, as we've been doing here, that is healing. The Buddha presented himself, in fact, as a physician. And he spoke of the Dhamma as like a course of medical treatment. And he saw his Sangha as kind of like nursing staff. So there's clearly a sense, particularly in early Buddhism, that the practice is actually one that is more concerned with healing certain conflicts, certain suffering, certain pain. It's an analysis of the world in terms of suffering and what causes the suffering. So clearly, it operates within the frame of therapy, in the widest sense. It's therapeutic. But on the other hand, he hasn't got anything to say about the Oedipus complex. Whether or not that exists, I don't know. But in practice, I feel that many people find that meditation can heal us in certain ways, can allow stuff that's been repressed, as you would say now, to come to the surface and somehow process through. But there are points we reach in our practice sometimes where the meditation doesn't work. It doesn't seem to be so effective. We need the support of an analyst or a therapist or a healer. And I think we need to acknowledge that that is the case. And as many people in this world of meditation have found out, to find a balance between the kinds of feeling that meditation can bring and also being aware of the sorts of issues that perhaps it doesn't work very well with. Well, I said that Buddhism was impermanent. I didn't say the Dharma was impermanent. That's another matter. The passage you're referring to is actually the opening lines of the Arya Parayatana Sutta. The one I've been quoting from, the one I gave the example of the Enlightenment from. You'll find that there. And he says, an ignoble search is one, he says, being subject to, wives and children, cattle, livestock, gold and silver, men and women slaves, the list. Being such things to be subject to birth, future, birth, sickness, aging, and death, to be subject to corruption. Why should I, likewise being subject to these things, seek my fulfillment in them? Why should I not seek fulfillment in what is not subject to birth, sickness, aging, and death? And then he says, Nibbana. Now, I don't want to go into a long thing about this. But this passage, in some senses, is actually rhetorical. And he's saying, look, this, to be caught up in things that are just subject to all of this collapse and decay and so on, I'm not going to find, just by pursuing these things endlessly, it's not going to get me anywhere. Is it possible, therefore, to seek something that is not caught up in such things? He doesn't use the word permanent in this list, and the key word is nibbana. And nibbana, we've seen, is the stopping of greed and hatred and delusion. That's quite clear. So he's looking for a way of life in which, or a way of being in which he's not subject to those conditions that keep him going round and round in a frustrating and endless search for something that will never deliver what he sees. Instead, he looks for this inner freedom from the very forces that condition such a life. That's how I would understand it. Now, clearly, you can read that in another way. And I think also, you have to look at, if you look at that sutra in context, it doesn't seem likely, because he says that in describing his reasons for renunciation. And it looks a bit odd, because he's actually saying, I should, instead of seeking all these things of the world, why don't I seek the goals of Buddhism? Now clearly he wouldn't have said that to himself, because he hadn't got anything yet. So I find that passage is, to some extent, a kind of rhetorical design to give people enthusiasm about these things. But of course in other passages, in other parts of this sutra, we do find that language, certainly. But the key to this, the interpretation of them, I would say, is in the Asankata Sanyutta 43, where he says, what is nirvana, what is the deathless, what is the unconditioned, and he gives exactly the same answer. It is the cessation of greed, of hatred, and delusion. That's where I would both my interpretation. I realize that there are other passages that can support an interpretation that suggests there is something other than the world. Personally, I don't find that convincing in the light of his emphasis on awakening as being that of dependent origination, of the understanding of the conditional nature of things. There are many ways in the practice with which, in which you work. Some you work much more closely with the teacher, and in some traditions they would say the relationship with the teacher is actually the crucial thing altogether. In certain traditions it goes forth. And that perhaps comes closer to the sort of analytical situation where you are primarily entering into an environment which is an interactive one. And in a therapist, if the therapist is a good therapist, if I'm sure you are, is one who's able to, in my understanding of this, the therapist has the capacity not to tell you what's going on about yourself, but to create an environment in which you can arrive at your own understanding, can facilitate in a myriad fashion. And I think it's similar in that, in a sense, the therapist is the Buddha, if you wish, or the teachers the authors of these different texts and the manuals and documents, as well as people who lead the street, who you can come and see and have discussions with. There is an interactive element there. And I think in the broader picture of one's spiritual development, this is clearly important, but more important really is becoming autonomous in your own practice. And to me, a good meditation teacher or Buddhist teacher is like a good therapist. The aim of the exercise is for the client not to come back. And likewise, to make a person, to give the people the tools so that they can work with them in a way that they become independent and autonomous. That would be the aim. So I think, again, it's a very individual thing. Some people, perhaps, for whatever reason, need a more supportive framework, and others seem to be able to operate quite independently with minimal interaction with the teacher. So I think we have a spectrum really here. I think Karen Horney spoke of auto-analysis in one of her books, suggesting that, you know, we must bring those analytical skills ourselves to bear on our problems as well. That would be my suggestion. I've written a book called Buddhism Without Belief, and some people think, oh, you don't need to believe anything. That's not what's meant. I distinguish between belief with a little b and belief with a big b. When we talk in ordinary language about a believer, we know full well that refers to someone who holds certain metaphysical views, certain beliefs, which cannot be, as you say, they are their assumptions, but can neither be proven nor disproven. And a great many religious beliefs about, say, God or karma or whatever it might be, these are things that you cannot actually falsify. And so, yes, they are assumptions. That's correct. And I agree with William James there, that the importance of them, the value of them, doesn't actually rest in being able to show that they're true or false, but as to whether they actually are an effective therapeutic tool in leading you to a deeper understanding of yourself, of your world, giving you a foundation upon which to act more morally and ethically in the world and so forth. So they are tools, they are a support in living a life, more than anything else. Yes, I agree with that.
Well, to me, well, again, it starts from the conditions. If you are very stable and you feel very healthy, mentally, emotionally, physically, then to be unsettled is fine. But if for some reason, either you are not mentally, emotionally, or physically stable for whatever condition, then that's why I would say, it's also do something which is easier. Because I think one has to bring wisdom to it. And when one is stronger, then one can then use a method and be a little unsettled and it will be okay. And in terms of, to me, the important thing would be stability. You know, if the person is not unstable, but you feel that there is not that haunted feeling, then, you know, the task of the teacher to be caring and to make sure that the person is either, I mean, it depends, everybody is so different. But generally, that's how one has to be aware of the people and try to kind of be in touch with what's going on. It's different, every situation is different. So I would say that the main thing you need to do is be aware, be caring, and also that it's not just you, but it's other people in the group. If they notice that, you know, something is a little strange, then, you know, not just to think, oh, it's a little strange, but to go and tell somebody about it. I think it's quite important. I think one has to be careful with the word engaged Buddhism. Because sometimes one thinks that it's a new thing. It's not a new thing. In 480 in China, there was a Buddhist who used to take care of the social services. So, and throughout the century in different places, in different ways, the people who were in the monastery, in the nunnery, or the ordinary Buddhists did things out of compassion to help other people. So that, I don't think it's a new thing. And also in terms of, I'm coming to the world of today. And in the world of today, you actually have so-called engaged Buddhists everywhere. I mean, I know a lot of them in Thailand who do a lot of very interesting things, which are social, political, even theory about various things. I know also in America, there are a lot of things happening, but at many different levels, from community building, to social action, to peace work, to prison work, too. In a way, to me, Buddhism is endless, because everybody The other style, one could be an unengaged Buddhist. You know, you engage with your neighbor, you engage with, you know, the baker or the postman or whatever.
Yeah, I don't like the word engaged Buddhism for the same reason, because it implies that most Buddhists are probably disengaged. Now that may be true. But the reason at the beginning of the retreat, I said that I want to come back to the basics. When you look at the actual structure of the Eightfold Path, to me that is a model of life that includes all aspects of our existence. But if one practices such a path, we're not only concerned with our own inner experience. I mean, it's quite explicit. It's how we act, how we speak, how we earn our livelihood. These are integral parts of the path itself. And I think it's very telling that many people translate this word bhavana as just meditation. The Buddha said that the Eightfold Path is to be bhavanaed, to be brought into being. In other words, your practice can just as much be about your ethical engagement in the world, about your economic life, about your concern for the suffering of others, in whatever context. And in other words, to me, the practice of the Brahma, if it is an authentic way of living your life as a whole, will necessarily lead you to be engaged with the world. So the essence of the engagement is what I was trying to get at this morning. It's the translation of your inner insights and values and yearnings and longings into forms of action that impact with the world in which you live. And I'm reluctant to set up a kind of a prescription of what that should be. Again, that's going to be a reflection of what any particular person is able to do in terms of their strengths and their gifts and their abilities and where they're at in their lives at that time. And so it's giving form to these values, instantiating these ideas in forms of life, in social structures, in works of art, in literature, in politics, whatever it is that you seek, as it were, to find fulfillment for yourself and for others. Yes, exactly.
In the world today, with all of this crazy what do you feel that you see that
Well, my role, I am an intellectual, I'm a theologian. If I were a Christian, I'd be a theologian, effectively. And that's where I feel I have some skills. So in terms of myself, that's what I do, I write. I put out ideas, I critique certain forms of Buddhist and religious practice, hopefully as an underpinning to give a framework for action. Clearly, I think the priorities in our world today are environmental. I think that's absolutely crucial. And more and more, it seems to be that we people are waking up to the fact that if we don't arrest this unstoppable consumption, we're going to destroy ourselves. Now, I think Buddhism has got a great deal to say to that, for how to live contentedly with less in a simple way. I think this is now becoming recognized as unavoidable. To find ways to get that idea across, not just as a theory, but actually to live it in your own life. I'm not an organizer. I'm not good at doing these things. My skills don't lie there. So that, I feel, is an absolutely crucial thing. I think to move towards an awareness of our impact on the global situation and find ways of life, whether it be political, economic, spiritual, social, that can make that awareness more present and can lead people to actually change the way they live. I don't believe the Buddha is omniscient. The Buddha himself quite clearly says in the Pali text when he's asked this, he says, no, I'm not omniscient. omniscient is knowing everything.
But like absolutely everything. You know, biology, geography, history, off we go.
And omniscience is a quality of God, which I also don't believe in. But if it's a human being to be omniscient is frankly absurd, is my understanding of that. And if you follow through the implications of what it would mean to be omniscient, you end up, it's an incomprehensible idea for a human being to be omniscient. I don't believe that at all. I think it's nonsense, frankly. And the idea of, I can see it as a way of saying that you honor the Buddha as being the optimal condition that human life could be, and you project onto it, you know, perfection. But I don't accept that. It's an idea that developed in the course of Mahayana Buddhism, which brought a great deal to Buddhism, but I think it also deified the Buddha in a way that I feel loses his humanity and loses our connection with him as a man on earth in social and historical time. That's another story. The idea that the Mahayana class, which is part of the Tibetan tradition, that nirvana, in other words, the cessation of suffering, the cessation of rebirth that the arhat has, is actually just a staging post to becoming a Buddha. Again, I think this is really a rhetorical and a sectarian view. I don't personally accept it, because I don't believe in rebirth either, so the whole model doesn't really interest me terribly much. And what was the third point? To me, that's elevating to the Buddha to a status of a kind of a divinity through whom manifests these different forms. Again, I just don't know what that could mean in a real sense. It's a beautiful idea, and I like to think of anyone who is awake as somehow one who radiates wisdom and love into the world. Yes, but manifesting different thought forms and bodies through different universes, I find really just a rather fantastic idea. Sorry about that.
Your way of thinking.
Oh, for my way of thinking, or the...
No, your way of thinking, that's the key.
Ah, good.
I'm sorry, but we've run out of time. But tomorrow we'll have some time, we can chat and comment and things like this. I'm very sorry about that. Good.
Okay, it's 5 o'clock, and I've been asked to say something about Dana, and when I've said my few words, then I'm going to invite Stephen Fulder to say something too, more specific to the system as practiced here in Torvana. Dana means generosity. In some ways, Dana is like caritas in Christianity. It's actually quite close to love, in a way. And I mentioned this morning how the Buddha, when he taught, he was actually giving himself away. He gives the Dhamma. It's a free gift to others. And both Martin and I have trained for a number of years, about 10 or 12 years each, in Asian traditions, with Tibetans, with Koreans, and others, who gave us all that we know completely freely. And, you know, we went to Asia without any money or resources, joined these communities, and were given the teachings, the practices, the moral and the emotional support in pursuing this path, and which has provided for us the foundations of our lives. Both of our lives have, in terms of our work, in terms of our activities, are all the consequence of the generosity of, in my case, you know, Tibetan refugees, people who have nothing, who came over the Himalaya. When I was in India, I'd only been out of Tibet about 10 years. and yet there they were given freely. And that's for me always been an aspect of this tradition that I very deeply honor. And it would be impossible for me, and I'm sure for Martin, to try to attach some sort of monetary value or price or some way of quantifying what we do in those terms. And so, in principle at least, if we are invited to see, then we accept that, not because we feel that it's going to make us rich and famous, which it doesn't, but because that's simply a response to our own gratitude, as it were, to what has been freely given to us. Now, this is obviously a reciprocal relationship. And Buddhist communities, the Brahma community, through history, have operated in this reciprocal way. Now, there is a giving, a receiving from both sides. We have received, I have received an enormous amount, and this enables me to give it in return, and for you to receive it, and I hope it's of value to you. And as part of your way of responding to that gift, is likewise to support the teachers, the monasteries or the organizations that enable that gift to be given. So you enter into a relationship of a free giving from both sides, in which there's no expectation, there's no calculative mind, how much is it worth? How do I calculate that amount? It has really to trigger a response that comes from your heart rather than from your brain, but at the same time, one that is taken within a full consciousness of your means, of your needs, of what it is that you are able to give, and to trust that this process of reciprocity will continue to underpin the continuity of this tradition. And I hope very much that this economy will continue to thrive and will continue to work, but it requires all of us to be active participants within it. And so there will be a box placed, I think a couple of boxes, and Susan will explain the technicalities of it. And whatever you choose to, or are able to give to Martin and I in response to what we have thought, that will be very gratefully received. But there is no expectation on our part of any kind of sum or figure or appropriate or inappropriate amount. Stephen. Whatever you can say in Hebrew, I'm sure you'll say in my book.
Okay, some of them in Kralim, they're done in Hebrew, Kralim. What we call Ayapo, the next Kralim for Stephen, Mishina believes Medida, Selim, Kamuyok, Selim, Mashim, from Malo, Mam, Kanina Kabel, is that a fair Mashim in the Adira for the Korreda, the Havas, Selim, the Minisim, the Mordiokan? And this, Aer, Sel Dana, Sel Medivu, Sel Medina, the top codes of our Sikhoyasa, the believer, are a halal and Sikhidami. Now, at most, the cold heart is speaking, the cold heart is speaking. It is just like Khazinra said. It is all Muvan Mela. The Kavanat model in Gun Chazak, in Abba, Sem, Halem, Aminu, Kulo Chazak, Kulo in Gun, with himself, Al Ezraf, Al Anachni, Zet Yach Lam. אין לי כך, אנחנו, אנחנו כולנו פה צריך להיות האימא, של מה שהרציפים, הפורם, הדרמה. ויש הרבה הוצאות, נשאלת, ואכלנו, ויש הרבה הוצאות. אז אני רוצה להסביר כמה דברים וגם כמה שפים. התחלה חשבתי, איך אני יכול לזכור כל הפרטים האלה על הפורם שלנו? אבל גם חשבתי, אני וגם ירד שלי, כל כך הרבה פרטים. אבל כל חשבתי זה גם פרטים. זה אדם של פרטים. קודם כל, עברנו לדמה אחרי הרבה מחשבות. עברנו לדנה שרים, פוטלי, זה אומר, הכל כל המנדרים בהודו. וגם החלטנו לא להגיד כמה בדיוק העלות, מי שרצה, מי שחשוב לחבר את האינפורמציה, אפשר יצא בשולחן עם כל האופור, בדיוק מסורה. אבל לא רוצה לדבר הדבר. ולפעמים יש שם אדם שלא יכול, ולפעמים יש שם אדם שכן יכול, ולתת יותר בגלל זה יותר שיש אנשים אחרים שיוצאת תמיכה. זה דבר אחד. יש מי קוצות, הודעות כולל כמובן טלפון, יש עוד שאנחנו לא מישהו שיושב מולכם, מורים גם, מורים דרמה שאומר שיש קרוב דרמה אנונים, יש מישהו שם שכותב את התחום וכמובן זה חשוב בגלל לפעמים שיש אז מישהו שיש קבלה אפשר, אבל צריך להגיד לבן אדם שיש כוונה, אפשר לקבל שקים, ושם של המורה, אין קבלות, לא כותבים דברים, זה קופסה נפרד, וזה לא שייך לכוונה בכלל. הקופסה של המורה, פשוט אין מזומן, מזומן כמובן עדיף, אבל אם אין, לא ביזה, אני חושב. לא ביזה. יש לי בערך שם, בחדר, הכל עכשיו. הכל עכשיו. השולחן שם מוכן, דבר ערך שם מוכן, הכסף מוכן, הבן אדם יושב שם. אני יודע שאנחנו עדיין בכסף, בפסיקה, וזה חוויה גם, זה חוויה של שחרור, זה חוויה שעולה כמה זה ומה ואפילו מול בן אדם, זה לא משהו רע, זה חווייתי, חוויה, זה חוויה עם תוצאה, כמו התוצאה, עם העולם, עם יחס, עם אחריות, עם נתינה, עם החלב אם, עם הלב, עם הכלכלה של הלב. אז זה כל בתוך האווירה של מסכורים, כן. זה עוד, וגם דרך אגב, שאפשר לתת שקים דחויים, אם זה חושב את תחום אחד החיום, אפשר לתת שקים דחויים. ולא רק שיש את המשך, זה סוג של יחד. מה המינימום של הטבע החצי? 30 שקל. תחום מסוים called Kodesh. There is an old Bible called Kodesh, and a Master Kabbalah. About the Lichen. I'll have a book.